welcome to the Iditarod, a podcast about what else? The Iditarod. I'm your host, Josh Edge. This year, Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio and NOM are teaming up to try something new. We're going to be doing one of these podcasts each week ahead of the last great race, and then once the race starts, we'll switch over to a daily podcast, and we'll have a new episode out for you every morning. The idea is you can wake up, make your coffee, brush your teeth, get caught up on everything that's happened in the last few hours on the trail. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, whatever podcatcher app you use, and that will ensure that you get the new episodes delivered right to your phone as soon as they're done. This year, we'll have two reporters out on the trail covering the 2017 Iditarod, and both are joining me in the studio today. We've got Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes.
Hello, Josh.
And we also have KNOM's Ben Matheson.
Hey, Josh.
This episode, we're going to look back at last year's Iditarod. We're going to go over some of the biggest events on the trail. Zach, you were out there and have some of the ground-level perspective on what was happening. And Ben, you were working as a digital editor and had sort of a bird's-eye view on the race. What stood out to you?
Well, we did see sort of the advent of Dallas Seavey as a four-time winner of the Iditarod, and also Mitch Seavey bringing in the second place there. But what you look back and really remember was things like the incident where Jeff King and Ali Zirkel were attacked by a snow machine outside New Lotto. Also the, the collapse of Brent Sass's race, where he went from being at the very front of the race by White Mountain to staying there for a day and dropping down to 20th.
We're going to cover all that stuff, but I'm curious to hear from you, Ben, a little bit more about like the CV dynasty that we may or may not be in. And, you know, was this race dissimilar at all from the last few where a CV was first into Nome?
What we had last year was that Dallas CV and Mitch CV had a close competitive race to the finish. We've seen Dallas CV win the past three Iditarods, and we've seen Mitch place, you know, second in 2016, second in 2015, plus a third place in 2014. He won it back in 2013. He's always been right there. But what we did have this year was Mitch Seavey and Dallas Seavey 2 minutes apart in Koyuk and 45 minutes apart at White Mountain. Both teams are extremely conservative during the first portions of the race. Dallas calls it building the monster. Mitch Seavey just runs a very scheduled, very conservative, very measured race so that when he arrives in Unalakleet, he can really just rip things open and move up several spots. In Unalakleet last year, Brent Sass is racing in front, but Dallas has a 4.5-hour lead on Mitch. So in Unalakleet, we see Mitch Seavey just blow through. Dallas picks up the snowhook, and then Mitch is in front of them as they're going up to Shaktulik. So one of those classic races up the coast, and you know both Mitch Seavey and Dallas Seavey have prepared the entire year for these few hours of racing, and you know they've got a similar style, and they've absolutely set up for this moment at this time.
And we actually have a piece of tape with Mitch Seavey while he was in White Mountain. Let's take a listen to that.
I don't mean it as a cliche, but I have two chances to win, and it's, you know, I'd a lot rather win myself, of course. I do everything I can. I'll give him nothing for free, but including dogs or college education.
Ben, you pulled that tape. Why do you like it?
I think the Mitch Seavey-Dallas Seavey rivalry is one of the more unique ones in terms of Iditarod's history. It's not the classic Rick Swenson, Susan Butcher, or Dallas Seavey, Ali Zirkel, or any of the classics from the 90s with Martin Boozer and Jeff King and Doug Swingley. This is a father and a son who you know are both extremely competitive, but are both good friends. And I love the way, too, that Mitch doesn't play this up for the media. I think that's just kind of how he talks. I don't think that's a canned line that he says, I'll give him nothing for free. Neither dogs nor a college education.
And fun fact, Zach has only lived here in Alaska while there has been a CV dynasty.
It's true. I moved here in 2013. Only CVs.
And moving back to what Ben alluded to earlier, probably the biggest piece of Iditarod news from last year on the trail was Jeff King and Ali Zirkel's late-night encounter with a snow machine near New Lotto. Emily Schwing was reporting from the trail last year for KNOM. She caught up with Jeff the next morning. Let's listen to a little snippet of that interview.
Last night, about 12 miles before I arrived to New Lotto, one of the many snow machines that were on the river struck my team at high speed. Did not hit my sled or me, and I am fine. I was not hurt in any way. But several of my dogs were hit. One was killed, one's leg was broken, appears broken, and one is in serious condition with shock and impact. I gave first aid to the dogs the best I could, loaded them in my sled, and continued on to Nulato, where I reported the incident. And at the point of impact, the snow machine's cowling had flown off. The driver did not stop, and he was a distant light. In an instance, he went by at 80 or 90 miles an hour, hit me, never slowed down. His snow machine cowling flew off, and he was gone.
Did he say anything to you?
At 80 miles an hour? No. Emily, I've told you everything that happened.
Yeah.
I gave the dog first aid. The guy was gone. He arrived at my sled at 80, and he never slowed down and departed at 80. I have two different lights on my sled. Everything has reflectors on it. It really felt like reckless bravado and playing chicken. Quite frankly, I've had it happen over the 40 years I've run dogs. Once in a while, somebody thinks it's funny to scare you by going close to your dogs and your team. Whether or not that's what's happened, I don't know. But the incident's been reported to the troopers as a hit and run. And I will be continuing on the race. The dogs have received expert medical care and are on their way back to Anchorage, the ones that were hurt. The other 11 and I got a little nap, and we'll be heading back out on the trail this morning.
So I think last year, while the CV competition was one of the kind of main stories about the race itself, this King and Zirkle incident was by far the biggest news event, and that really drove a lot of attention and the coverage that happened last year. And it had major impacts for, you know, what's happened in the year since with developments on the Iditarod's planning and the upcoming race.
So this incident took place overnight going into Saturday. And I remember in correspondence that day, this story really blew up. It turned into a national story. It absolutely was the biggest story on everyone's minds for the next few days. But I'm wondering, Zach, how did Emily actually go and find Jeff King and get that interview?
I was sleeping on a cot in Galena, and at about 6:30 in the morning, Emily Schwing was shouting at me, "Get up, Zach, get up." And she had just gotten the press release from Iditarod that this happened. And she has so much giddy up and go. And she just zoomed right out the door, got in the plane with her pilot, and flew to Nulato and kind of just cornered Jeff King while she was there. She knew he was going to be stopped there. You know, to her credit, Jeff King is a tough interview on a good day. And I think you hear in that tape a little bit that he was not excited to be talking about this, for some very legitimate reasons. And Emily just really pushed him and then found a way to get that tape uploaded before Jeff left. And for hours, nobody could really speak to him about what happened.
State troopers did arrest Arnold Demoski from Nulato for that incident. He was 26 when it happened. He's 27 now. Since then, he has apologized, and he said he was blacked out from drinking, doesn't remember the details of the night. According to Alaska Dispatch News, he was sentenced this past December to 6 months, 3 days in jail. That includes time he'd spent in jail since he was originally arrested. So as of mid-December, he had about 1 month left of prison time. And he was also ordered to pay almost $37,000 in restitution. That's a little over $26,000 for King and the rest for Zirkle. The reason King was awarded that much more is because his three-year-old dog, Nash, was killed in the incident. Now, Zach, on a recent reporting trip, you were at King's Kennel just outside Denali National Park. Did you talk about any of this with him?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about it. And I pulled some tape about what he said.
I feel very lucky that I was not seriously hurt or killed and that not more dogs were hurt. And I take some satisfaction in believing that Arnold Demoski has sincere remorse. And sincere remorse is a great step in the right direction.
Does King see any implications from that incident on this year's race for either himself or just the race as a whole?
Yeah, he most certainly does. King actually thinks that because of what happened on the trail, that was a big reason for why the Iditarod board approved the use of two-way communications. So that's in the rules. I believe it's Rule 35 about electronic devices. And this is a controversial rule change because it says that mushers can carry and use two-way devices, and that includes cell phones as well as satellite phones. Proponents say this is just the race evolving, that technology is out there. It's not cumbersome. It's very commonplace. And in the case of an emergency like what happened last year, mushers should have recourse, you know, even if they're a dozen miles from the nearest checkpoint, to call for help and let somebody know what's happening. Critics say this opens the door for mushers to potentially cheat and get outside help. And also, there are some people that say this really represents an eroding of some of the solitude and the mental challenges that mushers contend with on the trail. So you have people from both sides laying out the defense and the attack against this rule change. But King and other members of the board that I've talked with said, yes, the willingness of the board to consider this really did come out of an incident with Jeff and Allie on the trail last year.
It's interesting that this two-way communication rule comes up, especially after Brent Sass was disqualified on the 2015 race with his iPod Touch in the checkpoint of Tanana.
Yes, Sass hasn't had great luck on the Iditarod the last couple of years.
Well, let's hold on that just a second. This actually gets at another part of last year's race that I want to talk about. First, we should back up and just mention some recent news. A few days ago, the Iditarod put out a press release saying that Brent Sass has withdrawn from this year's race. And that news came less than a week after Sass scratched from the Yukon Quest. If you want to hear more about that, you can listen to last week's episode of the Iditapod where we talked more about it. Have either of you heard anything about why he made the decision to withdraw?
Nope. Ben?
There was a Facebook post that everyone saw where Sass was concerned about the health of his two dogs and wondered about a genetic issue related to those dogs, but we don't know anything else.
It sounds like a similar issue as to what may have happened last year. Zach, what happened to Sass last year that made him drop from third place running near the front of the pack back to 20th?
Basically, his team needed a break. Sass pushed really hard for most of the trail. He led the pack coming into a lot of the checkpoints in the middle of the race. And reporters and other mushers didn't really know very much about how his run was going aside from what was on the leaderboards. Sass likes to camp out on the trail and not spend time in checkpoints. His dad told me on the trail last year that part of that is that Brent is very social and gregarious and has a hard time not talking and chatting with people. And so for him, it helps his race if he just blows through the checkpoints and then can handle his dogs and, you know, feed them and rest himself without competing social distractions. But whether it's tactical or not, it also keeps people from seeing how his team is doing. And so when he got to White Mountain, he came in really close on the heels of the CVs. And, you know, he was leaving after exactly 8 hours rest. He was ready to just charge down the coast. But his team didn't feel that way. And I watched him pull and really try and cajole them into just taking off, and they just were not having it. So he brought them back, he restrawed them, and he let them rest. I pulled some tape from talking with Sass in the race shoot in Nome when he ultimately did finish in 20th place, about a day later than he expected to.
Does that say 20? 20's position?
Welcome in, man.
Thank you. Oh, man.
Brent, you talk about your trip in here, man. You had a heck of a trip this year.
Just super proud of those dogs. I mean, grateful, proud. I mean, they poured their heart out for 1,000 miles. And, you know, and obviously we had our problems 75 miles from the finish line, but, you know, this run here just proves to me that, you know, our trust is still there. They still believe in me. They still trust me to run their hearts out for the last 75 miles. They needed a little more rest. That was my fault. 100% my fault, and but they came through for me huge in the end and looked like a sprint team coming in to know we can't really beat that. And I mean, places in the end didn't mean anything to me. It's all about the dogs, and when they told me they didn't really want to go after 8 hours in White Mountain, I had no choice but to put them back on some straw and wait it out.
You know, it takes a little bit for me to get emotional, but listening to Brent Sass talk about his relationship with his dogs and about that bond and that trust just gives me goosebumps and makes my eyes well up.
I think past your cold Minnesotan facade, I do actually see a little bit of emotion creeping out of the tear ducts. Yeah, Sass is one of those guys that wears his heart on his sleeve. So I want to play another piece of tape from that same kind of interview in the shoot, because Sass really lays out what he thinks went wrong. It basically led him to take this massive, unplanned rest at the very end of the race, but for a while, he was really hanging in limbo about whether or not his team would even trust him again. And while I don't know for sure, I think this incident sounds pretty similar to Sass's Quest experience this year, and maybe that's part of the reason that he decided to withdraw from this year's Iditarod.
I mean, there was a moment on our way to Elam where it was me, Dallas, and Mitch all in a big, long row. And, I mean, that was... it was a pretty awesome moment. I was like, wow, we're 100 miles from the finish line, or, you know, 120 miles from the finish line in the Iditarod, and it's me and the Seavies battling it out. And that was a proud moment. And I needed to not get sucked under the moment and maybe read my dogs a little better and take another extra rest. But it goes way back into the race where I made mistakes, where I could have changed things up and did some different things in order to keep the dogs a little bit more sound. I mean, physically, they're in amazing shape. They all have great weight. They all look awesome. They ran into here amazing. Just mentally, I wore them out. I pushed it a little too far. But that being said, I will say that I am proud of myself for not just dragging them out of that checkpoint in White Mountain. As soon as I turned around after we went, 30 yards, and I looked back at 10 of my best friends, and they're all just saying, I don't think we want to go anywhere, Dad. I think we just want to hang out here. That's a pretty powerful force. And there was no way that I was going to make those dogs do that. I could have easily drug them out of there, probably, and got them down the trail and got them moving again. And, maybe even battling with Allie, but it just wasn't worth it.
And I'm off mic here, but I asked Sass what it was like to go back into the checkpoint with all of the other mushers still there after his team stalled.
I mean, last night when I went in the checkpoint, that was the most embarrassing moment of my life, sitting out there in that checkpoint, not being able to, my dog team didn't want to go. So when I went into the checkpoint, my head was down, definitely, and I felt like I just needed some sleep at that point. Before I got more frustrated and angry with myself, I just fed the dogs up a real good meal and went down. And then it was like I walked into the musher quarters and Wade and Pete are sitting there, and they're like congratulating me for running a great race, and nothing better than, peers there to sort of pump you up at the lowest time you could. And then so that, we were almost not joking about what happened, but joking about the race and how, somebody had to do it. And then I got some really good sleep. And obviously there were a lot of things that went through my head and what I should do, what I shouldn't do. The one thing I knew is that I needed to get my head screwed on straight. And it wasn't going to be 3 hours. It wasn't going to be 6 hours. It was going to be like a really good sleep. And or sleep / think session. And then I told myself I have one more chance. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to hook them up. And I'm going to, if I get those same eyes again, I'm done. Like, I'm not going to make them do it. But you could see it in their eyes that they were like, we're just really stiff from sitting here for so long, but we're ready to go. Like, that was the looks that I got from all those dogs.
Now, Brent Sass has a tattoo on his forearm that says, attitude is everything. And I just have to see things through a context of Brent thinking about his attitude, his dogs playing off his attitude, and that back and forth of him trying to have the best race while also being a top competitive dog racer. In an earlier interview, before they hit the coast, he told Emily Schwing, in reference partially to the forest fires that passed through his kennel area, this year I'm kind of living on the edge, and my theme song is Aerosmith's kind of Living on the Edge.
Pro fact, I believe he also has a tattoo that says Living on the Edge.
Haven't fact-checked that one.
Now, even though Sass has never won the Iditarod, he's definitely shaken up the field in the past few years. And we'll talk more about that in the next episode when we talk about this year's race. But while I've got you both here, are there any other memorable incidents from last year's Iditarod?
I listened to a lot of radio covers and read a lot of stories during last year, and there is one moment with Martin Boozer when he was a bit hurt that has stuck in my brain over the past year.
Around here, we refer to it in shorthand as the Boozer screaming interview.
Tell us about the interview. It was...
It was at Unalakleet, and the best place on earth, Unalakleet. And I heard a rumor that Boozer had gotten kind of hurt, and I saw him down at the checkpoint getting out of somebody's truck, and he was walking with a super, super, it was either a limp or a stiff leg, but he just did not look great. And some of the context on this, his son, Nikolai, a few months earlier in January of that year, had been in a really bad car accident and was getting, you know, advanced medical treatment down in Seattle. And so Boozer's doing this race, but he, you know, is obviously very preoccupied with how his son is doing. And then he, on the way into Unalakleet, had a really bad fall. And so I interviewed him about that. And this is the Martin Boozer screaming interview. What time did you get in?
I don't remember. A pain while ago.
Yeah, what happened?
Oh, I fell just before Old Woman Cabin. I fell and bruised the back of my leg really, really hard. And passed out a few times. I couldn't come to, so I just rested. Well, I'm sorry, buddy. I just rested up there until I could bear the pain and moseyed on in here and kind of worried about getting up and over the Blueberry Hills, so I think I might have to insert another rest. Just came from seeing the doctor, and they astutely diagnosed it as a deep bone bruise and bleeding and all that stuff, but you won't see anything until it starts showing, coming through the skin. But then by then I hopefully will be a gnome. I just do this to get your attention. That's just
me or the dogs.
I guess I don't know. I got their attention already.
They didn't bat an eyelash.
No, they've heard that scream. They've heard that scream the last few hours coming in here. Every now and again, I hit a bump and I do that sort of Tarzan cry, I guess.
I'm just curious. I mean, you've won this race and you've placed so high so many times, but why you can't quit, or what do you have to prove by getting there?
I got to prove that when you start something, you want to see it through. And I kind of want to do this for my son, who the last, since January 22nd, has a hell of a lot more to overcome than I have. And I'm so proud of him for toughing it out and making some pretty tough choices about procedures and carryings-ons.
Have you been getting updates about him?
I've been fortunately getting updates from friends and acquaintances, and that's so helpful. I've been seeing his progress, and it's nice. He's going to have lifelong issues like we all do, but he has overcome so much in the last 50 days that, I'm super proud to be able to go see him after this race. Got to get those guys a bowl of water.
And I remember seeing you come across Gnome in 2014. You had another knee injury, and I'm curious if this is the same one, or if this is...
No, this is totally different. Ah! It's okay. That makes good radio, doesn't it? I think I'm just going to leave these guys be, and I tried to heal for a few more hours. It's so nice and sunny here anyway.
Martin, I do not get how you're screaming as you're going up and down the dog line. I don't get how you're going to do 261 miles.
Well, that's the thing, is that's why I'm still here, because I don't know how I'm going to get up and over the Blueberry Hills. I'm looking at them in the distance there, and they don't look very inviting to me right now, so... But I figure if I rest them up there, the dogs are really good, so they'll drag me up most of those hills, but I know I'm going to have to help them a little bit here and there, and that's my issue, is right now I can't very much help. So... I don't know. I just, like I say, I'll take another sleep. I'll take a good 3 or 4 hours of sleep, and then we'll see what happens.
Okay.
Zach, Why do you like that interview so much?
A couple of reasons. I think it represents a lot about the Iditarod itself, the same grit and determination that it takes to do this really weird and esoteric thing with sled dogs. I think that's sort of a stand-in for the grit and determination applied to life at large. You have Boozer screaming and laughing in the same breath, and I think that kind of sums up this extreme challenge on the trail and just a general approach to life. It's a lot of screams and a lot of laughter, and those are just two sides of the same coin. It's also, like Boozer said, it's just great radio.
Well, last year's race definitely was not short on drama, and this year's mushing season is already off to an interesting start. That is all the time we've got for today. Again, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We'll be releasing new episodes on Thursdays up until the race begins March 4th. Then we'll swap over to the daily podcasts. Big thanks to Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes and KNOM's Ben Matheson for joining me today. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. Next week, we'll talk about this year's Iditarod, what's new, and what we can expect to see when mushers start their trek to Nome. I'm Josh Edge. Goodbye.
No, this is totally different. Ah! It's okay. That makes good radio, doesn't it?